Steiner, and as part of our New Economy Week coverage, we are talking about what the issues are in today's coverage of New Economy Week, which is the People's Climate Agenda. We are joined by Janet Redman, who is Director of Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies, and Jordan Estival, who is Senior Strategist for the National People's Action. And welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Thanks for having
us. So just to begin this, I mean, I know that there are many things that are about to take place. Paris is coming up with a climate conference. Janet, you're going there, I would imagine, right?
Yep, I am.
I'd be shocked if you said you weren't. And Jordan, I don't know if you're going or not, but I know your folks have been on the ground really organizing around this, so around these issues. So let me start, Jen, let me begin with, I mean, now that we've seen that the Keystone XL has been stopped, at least going through the United States, in the northern tier of the United States, which was a goal of many people in the environmental movement and many people in indigenous people's movements in Canada, but how does that translate into a different way of looking at building an economy around our energy needs and climate?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think this is a particularly interesting week, of course. So we had last week, I guess, was interesting, but the conversation we're having now, I think, is incredibly timely. We have Obama coming out against saying he'll reject the Keystone Pipeline proposal, which is huge. I mean, that stops one big piece of infrastructure for extracting, transporting, and burning some of the dirtiest fossil fuel on the planet. In the same week, you know, Obama says, I see no reason not to go ahead with the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, so the biggest trade deal to date that has an environmental chapter that says nothing about climate change, and in fact gives companies the right to sue countries like the United States when they put environmental regulation into place. So we've got a little bit of a schizophrenic climate policy in the U.S., and it really is mirrored in the global kind of climate scene as well. So as you mentioned, there are heads of almost every single country in the world convening in Paris at the end of this month at something called the UN Climate Convention. And that's a place where these heads of state are looking to sign an agreement that will be the next international climate deal. It really takes up from the Kyoto Protocol and is the only place where just about every country on Earth is addressing greenhouse gas mitigation, is addressing the drivers of climate change. What's really scary, actually, you know, at a moment when we know that we have to leave 80% of all the known oil, coal, and gas reserves in the ground if we're going to avoid triggering catastrophic climate change, in the draft discussion document that will be the basis of negotiations for this new global climate deal, fossil fuels are not mentioned one time. The word coal is not mentioned one time. Oil is not mentioned a single time. So we're seeing a really big disconnect between the spaces where we're looking to solve this truly a global problem with heads of state sitting at the table as equals and the reality of the drivers of climate change, which means we have to fundamentally shift away from an economy that's driven by digging, pumping, and burning fossil fuels and one that puts people and planet first. We're not seeing that reflected in the paradigm of Paris, which is really about how do we continue expanding economic growth and grow our way out of the climate crisis? How can we keep on extracting fossil fuels but doing other stuff like converting land into grassland that we burn and then bury the charcoal and use that as a carbon sink? So we're actually inventing new ways of making sure we don't change our old economy into a new economy, which is quite scary, I think, for many of us who see this as kind of a key moment in making sure we're not driving ourselves off the cliff of climate disaster.
So I wanted to pick up from there and Fair, what it means to build a new economy around our energy needs and climate. I mean, so and let me just, Jordan, let me just start with you and go right back to Janet. I mean, Janet, what does that mean? I mean, in the face of what Janet described, you know, we have this UN climate conference going on with multinational corporations really in many ways running the show, with countries like India and China and the U.S., for that matter, deeply embedded in the fossil fuel world. So what does this mean to kind of, from the grassroots, build something different?
Yeah, so the other, in addition to all the things Janet mentioned are happening this week, the other thing that's happening this week is that the EPA is holding its first hearings about the Clean Power Plan, which is, you know, President Obama's part of the bilateral agreement with China to reduce carbon emissions by 30% below 2005 levels by 2020. So, you know, the Clean Power Plan, the way that it works is essentially it requires every state, almost every state, to reduce its carbon emissions by to a level set by the EPA. And you know, that's all well and good. We need to reduce carbon, but there's lots of latitude given to the states around how they're going to do it. So, for example, a state could meet its carbon reduction requirement by just relying more on natural gas, which leads to more fracking, which has its own problems in terms of emissions. A state could just rely on more nuclear energy, again, which has its own environmental cost. Or then, you know, alternatively, a state could expand its investments in renewables, solar and wind, and so on. Could invest heavily in energy efficiency to drive down demand for fossil fuel-based energy. So these are all things that are very much in play. The way that the EPA's regulation is written now leaves it up to states to decide how they're going to do this. And then, you know, if a state does what we would prefer, which is to rely more on renewables and energy efficiency, there's still the question of, well, you know, who is going to benefit from these changes on the ground? Is it going to be, you know, corporations that then get, you know, tax subsidies to build green skyscrapers, or are we going to weatherize and retrofit lower income homes, which tend to be less energy efficient, and also provide an economic boost to people that are paying over the odds on their energy bills? If there's going to be more jobs created doing that work, who's going to get those jobs? How are they going to pay? So you know, we're in this time when the energy economy is in flux. There's some recognition now that we're going to have to reinvent it, but what the new one looks like is still very much in play, and we're really interested in making sure that the new energy economy doesn't mirror the old one in terms of being generally economically exploitive and exclusive.
So, John, when you're in Paris and you watch the shenanigans and the meetings going on in Paris, so to me, how does that play out to you in terms of?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to pick.
Sorry. No, go ahead, please. Just jump right in. Go ahead.
No, I'm just sorry. I was just kind of picking up on you know where Jordan left off. One of the things we're looking at certainly is the energy sector. We're also talking about agriculture. We're talking about forestry, transportation, things that are more in the resilience sector like water security. All of those things need to be, I think, when we're thinking about a new economy lens, all those things need to be looked at in the ways that Jordan laid out. It's about the technology, the type of technology being deployed, so is it dirty energy or clean energy. But just as importantly, we have to look at who owns or controls those technologies or those systems. At what scale are they being deployed? Are we talking about mega projects that have been known to displace people, disrupt communities, bring social, environmental, incredibly negative impacts, and, of course, who benefits? So I think part of what I'm looking at when I'm at the climate talks is Are the solutions being proposed really addressing scale, ownership, technology type, and benefit? But I think even more fundamentally, the piece that I really feel like the new economy frame offers is allowing us to question the fundamental understanding of what our economy is about. Right now, our economy is built on the idea that we can have unlimited growth on a finite planet. And in fact, we have to have unlimited growth. That's the only way that we help bring people in developing countries out of poverty. That's the only way we solve inequality here in the United States. We just grow and grow and grow and chop that pie up better. I think the reality of climate change is that's actually the signal coming back to us saying, actually, we can't keep growing like this. This is not working. And in fact, this is driving the climate problem in the first place. So I don't think one of the things that I think is really critical that's not being discussed at all in the hallways of the climate convention is this idea of limits to growth and redistributing the wealth that we have now more equitably so that people aren't in the global north consuming incredible amounts of materials that then lead to to global warming and climate change, and then the global south aren't sitting there saying, wow, the only way we can develop to meet our basic needs is through the cheapest energy sources available, and of course those are the most polluting. So that really needs to be addressed at the core of the climate talks this year.
So, you know, and again, let me shift it back here for a moment to the United States and community organizing and how that changes. And I look at things happening in Curtis Bay here, and Destiny and the others couldn't join us today, but so there you have a community working to try to create an economy and around clean energy and a source of clean energy for the community as well, and jobs. But I mean, there are a lot of contradictions involved there. I think in some ways, Jordan, that Janet, you know, laid out. I mean, because we have to come to a realization that we can't continue to live in the way we live if we expect any of this to work in the long run.
I think we're on the same page around that. We need to, in fact, change the way that we are doing energy and, you know, and industry more broadly. The fact of the matter is that, you know, the current way that we do energy, the current way that we do commerce, is based on extracting both, you know, fossil fuels, but also extracting wealth from the people who have the least of it, right? We think it's really important, both morally in terms of reducing, wealth inequality and also inequality in health outcomes, where we know that people of color in the United States have a much higher risk of being in heavily polluted areas, have much higher rates of asthma and other illness related to pollution. So there's a moral imperative to address those concerns, but also a political one where unless we start to involve the people that are most affected by these problems in creating the solutions, we're going to end up with solutions that mirror the current way of doing things, which tends to, you know, ignore and exclude the needs of the people who are most vulnerable.
So let's explore that for a moment. Let's explore it from both ends. And Janet, you know, I know that whenever you attend these conferences around the globe, around around energy and the climate, that there are always indigenous groups and workers groups from across the planet that are either having a counter conference, they're outside demonstrating, and sometimes actually inside. So
yeah.
What are the alternatives? And what are people saying in that macro level facing this about another way this can be done?
I mean, that's what's actually really exciting about these international gatherings, that certainly things are going on inside that matter and have material impact on people's lives. But the really dynamic, exciting spaces are the civil society spaces happening on the outside. And those are places where people from around the world, that's really where folks that are working on community solutions coming get together. I think a lot of the folks that are kind of the inside policy people are way focused on figuring out where the commas are and is it a must or a should or a shall, which is all great work. But I think the dynamic spaces that are happening in Paris, there are a number of them. You know, some of the things that I'm hearing about that I'm most excited about are, for example, there is a gang of folks that are talking, and I'll start from the inside and kind of work my way out. There's a huge coalition of people that are saying, you know, these UN climate summits have been hijacked by corporate power. One of the ways when we talk about a new economy that we talk about the shift is saying we're taking control out of the hands of corporations and governments that are not meeting the interests of communities, and we're bringing it back into our own hands. So a proposal is to include a provision that actually exists right now in the International Tobacco Treaty. It's called Article 4.3. It says that tobacco companies can't lobby and be part of delegations at the tobacco treaty talks, and they can't interfere with national public health policy that regulates tobacco. That doesn't seem like a crazy idea, but that doesn't exist right now in the climate talks. We actually have fossil fuel industry not only sponsoring the climate summit this year, but as serving as part of delegations to write the laws that should be managing them. So there's a huge, you know, huge push around that, which I think is really exciting. There are also ideas that are being brought into the climate space about disrupting concentration of wealth and power at the top. So there's a movement across Europe that's already succeeded in pushing 11 countries to agree to a financial transactions tax. France has been pressured to say, actually, we'll take some of that revenue, we'll take a big chunk of that revenue, and we'll put it toward climate solutions in hardest-hit communities in the planet. So there are things like that. You know, then there are kind of a huge, huge array of proposals that are happening at the grassroots level. So, for example, folks will be in Paris from the Global Alliance for Incinerator Alternatives, who are grassroots waste pickers and former recyclers, who have been doing mitigation projects through cooperative zero waste projects around the world, particularly in, I think the most exciting are municipal level collection of waste and composting and recycling by marginalized women in the lower castes in India. So, and those folks are bringing those ideas to share with other communities and take home. There's a world, it's called the World Village of Global Alternatives that will happen at that space. And then, of course, there'll be direct action. There'll be direct action against fossil fuel companies. There'll be direct action, I think, targeted at many of the countries who are negotiating. So there are lots of spaces where people are actually not only voicing alternatives and building together, but really projecting forward that sticking in the old economic system is actually not acceptable. It's not acceptable for the people whose lives are impacted, and it's not acceptable if we want to have environmental sustainability, if we want future generations to be able to live well, to survive in a good way on planet Earth.
So
I'd love to connect with Janet's point about community-based alternatives and, you know, some of the models that are actually being invented at the very local level as a means toward figuring out how to do things differently. So for example, one of National People's Action's affiliates, Push Buffalo in Buffalo, New York, has been, you know, for several years kind of figuring out, you know, how do they reinvent the depressed economy of Buffalo, which actually has the highest black unemployment rate in the country, you know, has lost more than half of its population over the years. How do they reinvent that? And their answer to it is, well, they're building a community-based economy that is also sustainable. So they're training local people in how to weatherize energy-inefficient homes. They're training local people to actually build net zero housing and install solar panels and geothermal energy. They're teaching young people to farm. They have urban fish farms and urban agriculture that where young people are learning how to actually, you know, start small businesses through this. And more importantly, like, or equally importantly, the local people are benefiting from all of this new creation. So it's local people who are moving into these affordable net zero homes, local people who have, you know, more local food sources now, and you know, it's concentrated in one neighborhood of one city, but we see a lot there in terms of potential models for how we could start to rethink how we're doing energy and agriculture. And so on. And what's exciting about this moment is that we're starting to make a lot of the connections from the ground up and the top down, where we're thinking not just about what we, you know, what people are just going to like start building with their own hands, but also how are we shaping the policies that allow them to do that. Things like on-bill financing for energy efficiency, or you know, community choice aggregation, where people are able to collectively choose where they get their energy. So there's lots of exciting things in development. The challenge is to scale that up.
That was Jordan Estival, Senior Strategist for the National People's Action. You also heard Janet Redmond, Director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. We're talking about New Economy Week, which is a public conversation about ideas to transform society and build an economy where the people and the planet matter and they come first. Today's day four. It's called a People's Climate Agenda, and we spoke about the climate crisis. We'll take a very short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll have a brand new episode of Soundbites. Well, we'll hear the second half of a panel I moderated last week on the community work happening in Baltimore to rebuild and build our food system. Then we'll hear a conversation about antibiotics in our food. Stay with us.